Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Welcome to this week's Failed Critics podcast. I am Steve Norman. I am joined this week by Owen Hughes.
Hello.
And Callum Petch.
Hello.
As we review new releases, Baby Driver and Transformers 5.5.
The last night.
Robots in Disguise and a few other things as well. Going to just flip the usual running order around quickly and do the news first because there is not much to talk about except we have a new website and we thought we'd best leave with that. It's still the same domain.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you don't have to look for us anywhere different.
We're still failedcritics.com.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you, but I feel like this is exactly as important as the Star Wars news that is going around that there. Like, we are up for our Star Wars,
oh, yeah.
I feel, in the important stakes here.
Alden Ehrenreich, they don't like him anymore.
No, guy. It's all about failed critics.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, fuck that guy. Yeah. We have a new website, or a new design for the website anyway. We've got a banner image so you know what website you're on straight away, which means I'd get rid of the horrible little logo that was on the corner for no real reason. The menus are working properly now. We've got actual, you know, nested menus so I can get rid of those fucking horrible text things we had before. And the carousel is gone, which I think is quite popular. You know, get rid of it is quite popular. I mean, the carousel itself was never popular. So yeah, it looks a bit flash. I've got rid of a lot of the clutter that was about the place.
It looks mad profesh.
Mad profesh, straight from Callum, so you know it's true. If people want to have a look at it and send me feedback, please do at FailCritics on Twitter, on Facebook.com/FailCritics or email failcritics@gmail.com. I'd love to know what people actually think about it. But we ran a poll on Twitter that ended about an hour ago. 3/4 of people who voted in that poll seem to like it better. So I'm taking that as a good sign.
It looks very good and all the hard work is very appreciated and worthwhile.
Well, that's okay. But yeah, no, I think it looks better. I spent a sort of afternoon fiddling around with it and I think I came up with the best free design that we could from WordPress. They're actually forking out any cash. I think it looks okay.
Yeah. On to the quiz... where I'm leading 2-1, and Owen is again hosting the quiz, me versus Callum.
Mm-hmm.
And if I win, Owen, I've got something in store for you.
Oh, do you?
Which
already?
Makes it, yes, and I always think that should mean or offer incentive for my opponent to lose.
I was going to say, like when you mention it like that, it makes me feel like I should throw the game back here.
But don't. No,
please don't. Please don't.
Well, not intentionally, anyway.
Oh dear.
Subconsciously.
Yeah, I could play into it, but I would really just hope people don't, because the last, like, how many of you won in a row now, Steve? I seem to have watched a shit film every week this year.
Do you mean best of three in a row? I've won the best of three quite a few times consecutively lately.
I can't think of any time this year when I've won it.
Amidst accusations of cheating.
And fixing as well. Don't forget, you've fixed a couple of quizzes.
Well,
cheating and fixing aren't those basically like interchangeable terms in this case here for this specific kind of quiz. But
yeah.
Well.
So this quiz is following the same pattern as the last couple. Steve, you're going to start -2 points again because I quite like that from last week. Callum, you're on +2 points. Guess the incorrect answer, you -1 from your total. Guess the correct answer, you +1. And there are trick questions which move you about as well. Be at zero by the end of the quiz. That's the aim. That's the goal. The theme of the quiz is... Is all Transformers themed?
Well, I'm definitely ending on minus 10, on minus 8.
Yeah, just out of spite. What vehicle does Bulldog the Transformer turn into, Steve? Is it A, a helicopter, B, a submarine, or C, a tank?
I think it's a tank.
Okay, and Callum, what do you reckon?
I'm going to say it's a helicopter.
Actually, it is a tank, so you both move 1 point closer.
So that's one minus one for those who need to...
Yeah, if you want. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Rodimus Prime was the true form of Hot Rod's spirit and body fused with A, Optimus Prime, B, Ultra Magnus, or C, the spirit of the human Daniel Witwicky. Callum.
Can I say C?
You can say C, yeah.
I want to say B, Ultra Magnus.
Well, it's a trick question. So you both move 1 point further away from zero. So minus two and two, just to clarify, back to where we started with. Basically, Hot Rod just gets the Matrix. That's it. He puts it in him. I think it came from Ultra
Magnus. Can I just
quickly
ask, are these questions based on the movies or Transformers lore as a whole?
Like, they are based on just the movies. So that includes the animated movie. Yeah. Not just like every single Transformers thing ever made.
Like, see, because I know that the wider Transformers lore gets utterly ridiculous. Like, I'd be able to sort of justify... Yeah. Like the nonsense, if it were all of it, instead of just these movies. God, how do I not know what happened? I've sat through all of them. How do I not know what happened to these?
Yeah. Well, that's why, because the Bay ones are just a complete nonsense. So remembering any facts from them would be a challenge. But there we go. Okay. Transformers the movie was released in which year? A, 1986. B, 1987. Or C, 1988.
You son of
Steve.
A bitch.
C, 1988.
Okay, and Callum?
Oh, God, what year was Stan Bush a thing? I'm going to say 86.
Okay, well, it was 1986. So
fuck!
Callum is a plus one. And Steve, you're a minus one. Minus three and three. This is the tightest this quiz format has ever been. In the animated movie, the Quintessons hold a kangaroo court, executing prisoners by feeding them to Sharktacons, Croctacons, or Raptacons. Callum.
I'm sorry to any Transformers fans who are listening to this. Right,
have you actually watched the animated movie?
I have not. No, it's one of the few things. It's one of the few. Which one sounds just the wrong amount of stupid? I'm gonna say Sharktacons because I know that robot dinosaurs are a thing in this universe. So,
okay, and Steve,
it's got to be Sharktacons, hasn't it?
Yes, it is Sharktacons. So, Callum, you're on 3 points. Yes, and Steve is minus two. Peter Cullen voiced Optimus Prime in how many films? One, two, or six? Steve, it's your turn to go first.
I'm going to say trick question.
Okay. And Callum?
The correct answer is six, but for my worst gate work, I'm going to say one.
Well, yeah, it was all six. Yes, all five of Bay's Transformers and the animated movie. So, Steve, that's minus 2 points to your score. You're on minus four. Callum is down to two. So, unassailable lead, maybe. According to Box Office Mojo, what is the total gross of all of the Transformers films directed by Michael Bay as of the 26th of June, 2017? Callum, is it $1.4 billion, $1.9 billion, or $2.4 billion?
Okay, right. Domestic or worldwide?
Whatever it was that came up on Box Office Mojo.
It'll be domestic. It'll be domestic. Sorry, yeah. Just realized it's got to be domestic because the other two, because if it was worldwide, it'd be well over, I think it'd be closer to 3 billion.
So 1.4, 1.9, or 2.4?
I'm going to say 2.4.
And Steve?
I say 1.9.
Okay. Well, the correct answer is 1.4 billion. So Steve is now a minus 5 and cannot win. Fuck yes. Callum, you're down to 1 point. Do you want to carry on, see if we can just do the rest of them? There's only four.
Nah.
No? Okay, fair enough.
I must say, it is weird for me to have, for me to have purposely picked wrong answers about there. Like somebody who needs to get stuff, like quizzes about right all the time about there. It's weird. Yeah. It's weird to hunt that stuff out.
I mean, usually I'd be more than happy for you to carry on with the questions, but considering it's about Transformers movies, I just don't have the heart, the will. We've got to talk about the film later, and, you know.
That is true.
Yeah.
That's enough of fucking Michael Bay and his shitty Transformers.
Once again, sorry to any listeners who are expecting some kind of respect for Transformers here. You enjoy your things. We just don't get it. That's the diplomatic way of resolving things here. There we go.
Yeah.
Yes, that makes the quizzes to all now. Next week is winner takes it all.
Sorry, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's all right. It's all right. It gives Owen a little bit of hope.
he's just been, you know, hustling me. That's what's been going on. He's given me hope. Just going to take it away next week.
Yeah. Just toying with you.
Mm.
So that was the quiz now to all. Time now for what you've been watching, where we have a look at some of the films we've seen in the last week or so. Owen, why don't you start us off with what you have watched?
Yep, okay. I watched a video nasty, a sci-fi horror from 1980 called Contamination, which... I will explain the story because I guess people might be interested, but it's just nonsensical. It's about some green, pulsating alien eggs that cause the people around them to explode. Yep. There's like government conspiracies, evil corporations, I suppose a bit of body horror. It doesn't make much sense, but like part of me thinks who cares because nobody ever watched this film for the story. It's basically, on some degree, an Alien ripoff. You know, I think it was released in 1980 when Alien was massive, Ridley Scott's Alien was massive. It's got a ship, although it's a boat, that's full of eggs. It's got a female lead in Colonel Stella Holmes, who was played by Louise Marlowe. But, I mean, it's not really a complete Alien ripoff because budget restraints meant it was set on Earth. They had a ship container, so they wrote a story around a ship container, essentially. But otherwise, it's not really anything like Alien. It's directed by an Italian guy called Luigi Cozzi, who his most famous work was Hercules from 1983, I should say, which is the Lou Ferrigno film, if you've ever seen that, where he throws someone into space. It's so fucking hilarious.
Oh, that one!
Yeah, I've seen it.
I've seen it. It's something.
It is something indeed, yep. This stars a few people... Well, I say stars. There are actors in it playing characters. There are three principal characters, and only two of them are worth bothering to mention, I think. One of those is Stella, who I mentioned, who is played by Louise Marlowe. She is a scientist and therefore intelligent and also a colonel. Ooh, how threatening for all the men. How do they deal with that? And one of those men is Ian McCulloch, who actually, within like the space of 12 months, he did this. He did Contamination. He was also in the absolutely brilliant zombie film, Zombie Flesh Eaters, which is one of my favourites of the genre. And he was also in the not-so-brilliant but still kind of decent Zombie Holocaust. All these three films came out within sort of 12 months. But he was basically known as being a B-movie actor. Ian McCulloch's character is also only introduced into this film, bearing in mind he is one of the three main characters and the other guy is just a nothing person anyway. After about 30 minutes in, and it just comes out of nowhere. So basically, Louise Moreau's character, she randomly blurts out halfway through this film, like half an hour into it, I should say, this like explanation about, oh, Well, there was an astronaut called Hubbard, obviously. Hubbard, because that's L. Ron Hubbard. Scientology's
God, it's like when Dead Space named its character Isaac C. Clarke. Do you get it?
Yeah, exactly. So Hubbard, he went to Mars and came back mad. Don't you remember that in the 70s, guys? Don't you remember when we sent people to Mars and these astronauts came back? Because up to this point, the whole film, as far as we know, is set in reality. It's set in the modern day 1980. And then all of a sudden, it's invented this story about us sending humans to Mars. You know, one of the guys is still up there. One of the guys was just crazy and they've left him on the planet. But they brought another one back, which is Hubbard. And now he's stark raving mad. He's a lunatic who, as it happens when they visit him, he's fine, really. He's just a bit depressed. And he soon snaps out of that when he sees a pretty woman. Which kind of brings me on to, like, the worst and, by the same token, the most hilarious scene in the film. I'll set the scene for you. After cracking the conspiracy theory, the mystery of what's going on, Moreau and McCulloch, they're caught by the bad guys and they're tied up together. This is despite the fact that for most of the movie, the bad guys are basically been trying to murder them in, like, more and more elaborate ways, such as locking Moreau in a bathroom with one of the pulsating eggs and locking the door, going outside and putting a do not disturb thing on the door. That was it. And then you get like a 5-minute montage of her screaming about there's an egg in here. Get me out. There's an egg. There's an egg. I'm in the bathroom. There's an egg for about 5 minutes, which is just fucking hilarious. But anyway, so they're tied up together. They're in this this basement and back to back, as I said. Now, for most of this film, the best thing about it is the score, which is by Goblin. So if you know anything about sort of video nasties, if you know anything about horror films, Goblin of the guys who've done the best scores. They did Dawn of the Dead. They did Suspiria. That's Goblin. That's them. They did the score to this shitty fucking low-budget alien ripoff. But that score goes out of the window for this scene, which is replaced by a generic, soft, cheesy, romantic score. Now, I've got exact dialogue. I was watching this film like, this isn't real. This can't be a fucking... This isn't serious. So I had to write down the exact dialogue. Moreau turns her head towards McCulloch and she says, "You should have listened to your good old cop instincts instead of my MIT educated calculations." Right. To which McCulloch says, "You know something? You've always made me feel like a caveman. You're the first woman that I ever went after that I couldn't get past first base with." To which she apologises. She says, "I'm sorry." So he says, "Well, imagine how I feel." At which point she turns around and snogs him.
That sounds like 70s exploitation cinema to me.
Yes, it is the most fucking ridiculous. This is all basically after, like, because like, even though she's like a brainiac, she's the scientist, she's the clever one, and he literally doesn't do anything brave or heroic. But of course, what he does do is he slaps her when she goes a bit hysterical and she sort of thanks him for doing that. Because 80s, because exploitation, you know. And of course, she's a woman and therefore she can't resist him. Because look at him, he's the very embodiment of manliness. It's awful. I mean, without like meaning to sound incredibly racist, you can tell this was made in 1980 and that it was made by an Italian genre director. Because it follows all the same tropes of every film made by European cinema at that time.
I mean, that probably slightly explains Goblin there as well. I mean, again, like as noted on one of the new Mystery Science Theater 3000 episodes, James Horner did Wizards of the Lost Kingdom before he went off and did, you know, like Avatar and Titanic and all that stuff from there. Like, you know, sometimes you just got to eat. You got to go soundtrack shitty Italian alien knockoffs.
Yeah,
but probably still better than Ridley Scott's modern alien film, Cough.
What? I loved Covenant. I thought Covenant was great. We won't get into that.
No, we won't, because we will be here all day. We will be here all day.
But this is just awful. Score aside, it's a pile of crap. I was hoping for something a bit like to set it up like other video nasties or banned films or just general horrors of that era. You know, stuff The Stuff, actually, I was going to say. The Stuff, the film The Stuff is great. Or Night of the Comet. But actually, it's a bit more like Deadly Spawn or Eaten Alive or something like that. So if you're familiar with the genre, it's not a well-thought-out, well-made film restricted by its budget. It is just, let's throw some gore and like we'll capitalise on the things that are popular at the moment kind of movie. Exploitation cinema at its worst.
Yeah, again, welcome to the turn of the 80s.
Yeah. It was on Shudder, if people are signed up to Shudder and want to give it a go, but I would advise not doing that. There's plenty of other quality films on Shudder to try out before you get anywhere near Contamination.
Like?
Well, they've got Maniac Cop, for a start, if you want just gruesome exploitation cinema. They've got classic Nigel Neal stuff, you know. The Abominable Snowman is on there. They've got Quatermass Experiment, if you want classic sci-fi. They've got actually a good selection of horror films, but Contamination isn't one of
them. There we go, folks. Bonus recommendations. You get those ones for free.
Yes.
Yes, and that was Contamination.
It was.
This week I have seen, as well as watching some of the other previous Transformers films.
Oh, you poor thing.
Well, I don't think we'll cover this later, but I actually like Transformers 1. I think it's like the first one. I think it's okay.
No, yeah. I'll semi-defend Transformers 1 when we get there as well.
But after that, it's just garbage. Yeah. Actual garbage for the eyes.
Mm-hmm.
But I watched War Dogs.
Oh, the Todd Phillips one. Jonah Hill, Miles Teller.
Jonah Hill, Miles... Yeah, and I didn't think much of it at all, really.
It's based
on a true story about some guys in their mid-20s who get involved in gun running, which seems to be legal to an extent, what they're doing. They're kind of bidding on contracts put up by the US government, the kind of smaller contracts that bigger businesses ignore, and they pick up on it and make a decent amount of money. And it's based on a true story about these guys. I haven't really had time to look into it yet, because I only watched the film yesterday, so I don't know how much the film is based in reality, how much of it is true, how much artistic license to use, but it's just a bit nothing. I mean, the plot moves along. No, you don't really get invested in any of the characters. You don't find out too much about them, their motivations for doing what they're doing. I mean, you do on a surface level, but nothing really deeper. You don't really connect with any of the characters. You don't really care about what happens to them. But you do kind of want to know what happened. In a lot of ways, I'd have much preferred to have watched a documentary on the subject with some dramatic recreations of some of the things that happened. I think I would have found out a whole lot more about the actual story and found it a lot more interesting and informative rather than this film.
Yeah, yeah. I saw it when it came out last year and just kind of was like really like sort of wanting to like it in the sense that I've been waiting for Todd Phillips to actually finally just turn around and stop being shit for like half a decade now. But just... Like, the problem is, with it mainly, is that, like old Todd Phillips films, that it can't help but romanticize the behavior of its utterly horrible, abhorrent, like, lead characters. So what should instead be, like, Todd Phillips' version of The Wolf of Wall Street? Which, I mean, is clearly what he's wanting to try and do.
Yeah, that's what he's going for, definitely.
Yeah, because you...
Or Pain and Gain, to use the Michael Bay...
Exactly, like Pain and Gain, yeah. Sorry, go
on. When you look at the poster for this film and you see the trailer, you think are they going to try and play this for laughs? Is it going to be kind of like a comedy type? And it's not.
Yeah,
it's not even like it's just a bad comedy with bad jokes that don't make you laugh. They don't play it for laughs.
Yeah,
which is fine, but it just doesn't seem very interesting. A film about two 20-year-olds, a true story about two guys in their 20s. Who go all around the world dealing in arms. They smuggle guns from Italy to Iraq. That should be really interesting. But it's just not.
Yeah, like the problem with it is, and this is kind of why a lot of like Wolf of Wall Street wannabes and that there haven't worked, and this is also exactly what I found wrong for Riot Club, is that in order to make, one reason why Wolf of Wall Street works is because while it's fun, it's because it manages to walk that fine line between being to be like being aware that everybody involved is awful and yet still being able to be fun at the same time, like sort of like recognizing that what's happening on screen is wrong, whilst at the same time acknowledging there's a kind of perverse thrill to watching these people be horrible.
Or perhaps with Wolf of Wall Street, I don't know about other people, you know, watching what they're doing and thinking, yeah, that's pretty bad, but
yeah
I'd fucking love to be doing that.
Yeah, yeah, like that's it, because Scorsese understands the allure while also understanding that audiences are smart enough to realise what being told is wrong without having to be like lectured to or condescended to. And like War Dogs, to me, simultaneously doesn't actually seem to have any real moral compass, because Todd Phillips' films only ever have, like, their only ever moral compass is the relationship between the two bros in the center. Oftentimes with a kind of like the straight man and then the really horrible person out there who's meant to be wacky comedy, and that occasionally comes through recognizing just how horrible that person is, but mostly just kind of looks at him as a kind of sympathy, goofy guy. Like The Hangover. Like, because like Zach Galifianakis' character in The Hangover is a horrible human being, and yet he somehow becomes the moral moral emotional center of that entire universe for reasons that are lost to me.
Well, do you think that War Dogs is kind of like driven mainly by Jonah Hill? Because, you know, he got a lot of success for his part in Wolf of Wall Street. He got an Oscar nomination, I believe.
Yeah, he did.
For his role in that. So, I mean, do you think he thought, well, that was fun, let's do that again, I can do that kind of film again and that'll be received successfully.
But he wanted to be the lead in it.
But he wanted to be the lead, yeah.
Yeah, again, there's that. It's just that, it simultaneously doesn't want to have any fun with it, the premise and that there, but also kind of isn't removed far enough to realise that these two people are horrible people who are awful to each other, and there's no reason why we should be happy about it. So you get, like, the worst of both worlds, really. Mm-hmm. And despite Jonah Hill being, like, very, like, magnetic in terms of screen presence and that there, and Miles Teller being okay, like, it's one of his better Hollywood roles, because Hollywood doesn't know what to do with Miles Teller.
Nobody does. The only thing that he's been good in is Whiplash, and even then it was a shame for him because he was so completely overshadowed in that.
I thought he was good in The Spectacular Now, which coincidentally was on BBC One last night. But like, that's another thing for another time. But like, outside those, it's kind of just, like, it never seems to figure out what exactly it's trying to do or say. So it just, and also old Todd Phillips films is like 20 minutes too fucking long.
Yeah, it would have worked so much better. I think I would have enjoyed it more as 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Because it's just so bloated.
Yeah, like at a certain point, I feel like I just need to give up on Todd Phillips, because I used to enjoy his films and that, but, you know, old school Road Trip, even the Starsky and Hutch movie that kind of fluctuates back and forth in people's quality, things like that. But like, I think specifically since he made The Hangover, he's been on a very horrible, excessively mean-spirited like vibe of extreme bro douchiness that I personally cannot abide and just find kind of repellent. And that this movie, which should have been him actually full-on interrogating that kind of thing, instead he just kind of came to and like shrugged his shoulders and thought, well, I guess if I call out to other better movies, maybe people will be mistaken into believing that this is a movie of interest with something to say.
The ending is, as well, again, I don't know if the ending is based in fact, what I would suggest very much it's not, so why put it in there? But I might be wrong on that. The very end scene, I mean, with Bradley Cooper's character. I mean, surely if that happened, you're not going to put it in the film, because that just implicates you in a whole lot of things. But maybe I'm wrong, because I haven't really looked into the truth of everything and the whole backstory of everything. Like I said, I genuinely think I would have been better off watching a documentary or reading a really good article on the two characters.
Well, there is actually one available online. I had it up just now and I've shut the page because for some reason I didn't think to mention it there. Hang on, allow me to stall for time quickly while I mention that. Arms and the Dudes by Guy Lawson is about that. So maybe read that.
Okay.
I haven't read it, but apparently it's quite good, so...
Okay, so that was War Dogs. And Callum, what have you seen this week? You're going to review one new release in this section, aren't
you? Yeah, I'll do that first, because Steve really wants to hear about The Book of Henry.
from the trailer, I like the idea of it. The trailer gave away pretty much everything.
Oh, Christ. That trailer was amazing, though, wasn't it? Yeah. Just like a role in its own, it's technically probably one of the best films of the year, quite frankly, just in terms of like pure emotional reaction, up and down, up and down. Right. So, yeah, Book of Henry, which is Colin Trevorrow's new film, Colin Jurassic World, Safety Not Guaranteed, Star Wars Episode 9, Trevorrow. Based on script that has apparently been bouncing around Hollywood since the mid-90s. Since the late 90s, by Greg Hurwitz, who's apparently a comic writer.
Yep.
Yeah, and by the way, it feels like it. Like it's the kind of film that specifically, like, that when smartphones come up as a phone people go to, it feels like really out of place since people record things on tape recorders and like Polaroids and all that shite. Like, I'm torn between wanting to just recount the plot and actually offer genuine criticism here because I actually sort of love it.
What?
like both on the ironic car crash level, because this movie is like, objectively, it's bad. It's a bad film. It's a complete mess. I loved it on both like an ironic train crash level and like on a sort of genuine thing. Because like the plot, for people who don't know, stars Jaden Leverhurst, the kid from Midnight Special, as Henry, the main character, rather, who is the eldest son of single mother Susan, played by Naomi Watts, who lives out with also a second son, Peter, played by Jacob Tremblay, otherwise known as the kid from Room. Henry is a very, very smart boy. You'd say gifted, but he prefers the term precocious, as he says in actual dialogue that is spoken by human beings in this film. Mm-hmm. He is a whiz at school, absurdly popular with all the kids and that there, constructs a giant elaborate Rube Goldberg machines in his spare time.
I did just think you just said he was at wizard school then.
That honestly would not be too much of a stretch given this movie. Anyways. But yeah, he speaks in grand philosophy, like he's already an expert in philosophy. He plays the stock market using the payphone outside of his outside of his school, plays chess against teachers and wins, and effectively controls the entire finances and everything of his family and that there, so that allows Susan to essentially act like a child who gets to sit at home and play video games every day.
Basically, if he was one of your friend's kids, you'd hate him.
Yeah, you would. Really hate him. Like the Carpenter family and that there are all perfectly well off because Henry has purposely kept all control of their finances, of their pay slips, stock market controls, 401ks, everything. He's such a whiz. So he essentially allows Naomi Watts to sit and play Gears of War all day, every day. That is not a joke. That's a real thing that happens. And you better believe Naomi Watts gives some fine fake video game playing acting there. Oh boy. He's like Naomi Watts' best friend is an alcoholic played by Sarah Silverman, who is basically the Newman to Henry Seinfeld.
Newman.
Not kidding. They both have like a genuine like sparring back and forth kind of like faux hatred thing that they even spell out at one point of we're just pretending to hate each other because we don't want to admit our true feelings for one another. It's fucking ridiculous. Yeah. Right. They live next door to Dean Norris, who is the police commissioner and stepfather to a girl called Christina, who Henry is very sweet on. However, Henry finds out through just general deduction, as in of a general demeanor of not even having spoken a single word to Christina at all that here, that Dean Norris is sexually abusing her. But he can't do any. But nobody can do anything about it because Dean Norris is the police commissioner, the Child Protective Services. They're headed up by his brother. And nobody at all seems to believe Henry, the giant whiz kid who they otherwise take for word at everything about there, that somebody is being abused and out there. So Henry decides to construct an elaborate plan to have Glenn killed with a sniper rifle, a high-powered sniper rifle with a silencer. But before he can enact it, and this is the big twist that all the trailers hid, in case you're wondering that here, but it happens within like 20 minutes, so I'm going to tell you anyway, he has a brain aneurysm and dies.
Oh.
Yeah.
That comes out of nowhere, doesn't it?
Well, he has the aneurysm and then he and then spends 20 minutes in hospital putting together all the rest of his plan and finances of that there, so that then he can leave the detailed instructions for Naomi Watts to follow through the plan to kill Dean Norris. I forgot to mention as well, by the way, he puts together this entire plan, like this entire very detailed step-by-step to the second plan in the space of one night before he has his aneurysm, and then records all the step-by-step instructions to tape with exact timings, where he's even able to know that Naomi Watts will go down the wrong corner at one point, so he needs to correct her. It's this movie is mad, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's also kind of actually like good. Like if you strip away the madness, like the absolute madness makes of a plot that there, like the actual, like by which I mean the child molestation stuff that there. What you actually have here is kind of an interesting deconstruction of that kind of like precocious child prodigy film. You know, those ones that other people play. Did any of you watch Gifted 2 weeks ago?
No.
No,
okay, right. So. Be glad it's insufferable, because I watched that before the Book of Henry as well. But you know, like that kind of, you know, like special child out there, like Rain Man child who knows everything, sees everything, is very precocious and la di da di da di da. This is basically kind of a deconstruction of that, of watching somebody out there, of looking about and reminding you forcefully of this is a child, their kind of morality is like all askew out there, and how fucking weird it is for them to be like that in control in that kind of way. But it's also aiming to be like an examination of the trials of single parenthood, you know, of grief. I mean, also the idea of like traditional patriarchal family dynamics, you know, of like the father figure controlling everything out there, but humorously juxtaposed by said father figure being the 11-year-old son. the concept of boss baby. Yeah, like, yeah, being yeah, except well, in the original storybook version instead of the film version, which turned into a metaphor for capitalism. And it's all honestly, it's all told like so earnestly, so straight faced, in a way, with a whole load of cast, like a very talented cast who are all trying their hardest, with the exception of Dean Norris, who really doesn't like he'd rather be anywhere else. But it almost sort of circles back round to being legitimately working, like in what it's trying to do. I mean, it doesn't. For the record, it doesn't, because. Well, for one, all the paedophile neighbor stuff is just like so aesthetically not thought through in the slightest. Mm-hmm. What's especially great as well is that like it only shows up for like 2 minutes. Like that whole Fred Lee just shows up like 2 minutes before Henry gets his brain tumor. Oh shit, we need to set this up now so that we can do that sudden pivot in the final third. But then also like it's just dreadful, it really is. Like the actual screenplay is ineptly written, with all the characters just refuse to speak in any way that relates to a human being. And scene construction of structure map there is just really, really poor. The tone is wildly indecisive. For some reason, the finale keeps cutting back between a humorous talent show and Naomi Watts getting ready to kill Dean Norris. I think there's meant to be some kind of tension in there. It doesn't work in that kind of structure. Oh, and also the fact that Trevorrow cannot direct for shit. I like Jurassic World more than most other people, even whilst I recognise that it's not really a good film, like by normal metrics. But I absolutely do get now why he's like why most people say he's a bad director. For one, there's that issue that a lot of directors have nowadays, where they seem to simultaneously overtell with their direction and not tell enough. You know, I have a kind of direction about there where they cut between things and have characters do stuff, but not to such a extent that it makes sense if you think about why somebody's doing something, but it doesn't sync up until after it's done, or if somebody like throws a line afterwards when it's done and that tells you something about there. Like, think of like many of the late latter day Pirates of the Caribbean movies. For example, Matt, like this, but also just like again, just his direction. He cannot do tension. He cannot create any tension at all. Mm-hmm. Many of his actual scene constructions about there are all over the place. Tone off. Like, I mean, it's very difficult. It's a very difficult movie to direct anyway. Like, I'm not really sure if anybody could have truly made it work. But Trevorrow just turns out to be very, very bad at this. So anybody worrying about Star Wars, you can. Feel free to continue worrying because he's not a good director, but you know, maybe a material. But like the fact is the Book of Henry is like an unholy Frankensteining of like four different mediocre indie dramas, like into this one deformed being of monstrosity. And whilst all four of them on their own would have been objectively better movies, I don't think I would have enjoyed any of them as much as like this one. as much as like this freak of nature, because like, God help me, give me a batshit entertaining train wreck over an insipidly boring slot pile any day of the week. You know, it's tries. I think I only sort of get what it's trying, but it tries at least, which is more than I can say for a lot, like for like fucking Gifted or whatever. So yeah, that's Book of Henry. If anybody does put that down as worst film of the year, they're not being honest with themselves. I won't put that down right now, but...
Well, without even watching it, I can tell you there's probably one that we're going to talk about on this very podcast that'll beat it.
Yeah, but like, that's what I mean. Like, people are genuinely like giving that 0 stars, but I don't think they're really understanding what like metric of a properly bad film is nowadays, and that like it's the entertaining kind of bad, even if I feel like it could probably actually have been slightly crazy. But anyhow, the film I actually want to talk about, I'm going to have to do this very quick because I inadvertently spent too long on Book of Henry, I watched The Skeleton Twins in the 90 minutes before it was yanked off of Netflix again this week.
I've heard good things about Skeleton Twins. Lots of people... I think we had Brian on here a while back who said that it was really good.
Yeah. I'm going to put it down this way right now. If it weren't for Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig being as fantastic as they are, I would have found this insufferable. That was not meant to be a dramatic pause. I'm just trying to stop burping into the mic.
okay.
Like, is the... The problem is that it's very, very well-meaning. Like, it's a very well-meaning indie film that cannot stop desperately being an indie film. If that makes sense. Have you watched Jeff Who Lives at Home, the Duplass Brothers movie?
I haven't, no.
Is that the one with...
Jason Segel and Ed Helms?
Yes, I've seen that. It's very good.
Yeah, like I constantly went back and forth on whether I was liking it or not, because for every scene that feels real and honest with like genuinely likable characters and actual like profundity to say, there's a ridiculously out of nowhere faux profundity scene, or like that entire bit of the ending, you know, the motorway pile up and all that stuff from that there, and just like in ways where it kind of just... where it pushes against itself into trying to become something a lot faker, like faker manufactured than the like small scale story it is. That's kind of what I found with Skeleton Twins, in the moments when it's actually focusing on Hader and Wiig and them together and the film about depression, like chronic, miserable, beating down depression, suicidal tendencies, and how kind of dead end circumstances and inability to find some kind of happiness in what is objectively like a nice life and that there wears you down, and how you can still have like familial connections that can help bring you through. When it's on that, it's really, really good. Really, really good, really, really affecting. Especially because Hader and Wiig are on like career redefining performances here. Kristen Wiig, obviously, because this was a point when she transitioned from making comedies to being more of a indie dramedy actress, and Bill Hader instead of went off and did voices in the Power Rangers movie. That's a waste of his talents, but he's fantastic here. Also really good here, Luke Wilson, who is normally just really distracting for me in movies for some reason, but he's really good here as like the kind-hearted lunk, like the kind-hearted, good-natured lunk who plays Kristen Wiig's husband. The problem is, though, is that the movie can't stop piling on all these other indie movie tropes on here. Not just in, you know, like the kind of direction of, you know, excessive soft focus, gently strummed soundtracks, acoustic guitars, and then subplots involving statutory rape and sex addiction and cheating on spouses and the inevitable attempted suicide scene that is visualized on screen for the climax, obviously. Incidentally, by the way, just as a brief sidebar here, the reason I have been thinking about this recently, because I saw Christine at the London Film Festival. Fantastic movie, available on DVD now. You should all go watch it. And how that ends with the suicide, like it actually shows it. And I've been trying to think ever since, like, because the Skeleton Twins suicide sequence of that here really annoys me. Like, it really deep down annoys me on like a visceral level. And I was trying to figure out why that happened, but when Christine did it, I was okay. And I think it all comes down to delivery. Like, Christine's entire movie is building up to the suicide attempt in the same way that Skeleton Twins is building up to the suicide attempt, you know, for its finale and that there. But Christine kind of treats it with like genuine respect. It's the whole movie is about showing you how she got to that specific point to feel like that suicide was the only thing she had left. And the actual act itself is not romanticized or glamorized or played for like for additional drama out there. Like the suicide happens and then it shifts focus to showing just how horrifying the act is, how much it affects other people and all that kind of stuff. When Skeleton Twins does it, it does it purely because it's the finale and we need some kind of redemptive beat. Like there's a tactlessness to it there. In the same way, again, that it throws in its statutory rape subplots, its bits about sex addiction, all that stuff from out there. Like, it just kind of throws it in and treats it as nothing more than added drama required for a finale, if that makes sense. And that's ultimately what I kind of find wrong about it, is that like it's simultaneously trying so very, very, very hard to be respectful towards its subjects, like towards everything it's touched on, but it can't help but make a giant pig's ear of the whole thing. And that if it weren't for Hader and Wig and those occasional individual scenes, which are mostly separate from all the other bullshit for the rest of the film, the movie would be genuinely insufferable. But because of those two and how, like, and they're pure... Like and the life and the strength and the emotional investment they put into that, they put into the script that won't meet them halfway. It turned into something that kind of almost worked, but ultimately doesn't, and that just kind of hurts me more. Again, because of my own issues with depression, I've got my clinical depression out there. I take stories like this a lot harder than maybe other people do out there. But it does mean that when they miss. Like, but when they hit, like with BoJack Horseman or something, or Christina out there, like I connect someone on a real deep visceral level with a huge, like with a huge appreciation. And when they miss, like with say the Skeleton Twins, or I haven't watched it, but everything I've heard about 13 Reasons Why just makes it sound like the most triggering, horrific garbage, like on this planet, like possible. Like I get a real like visceral hate on like a deep like offense on a deep down level because of my own struggles with that kind of thing. Again, it's well-meaning, but it can't help but unfortunately it just kind of makes a pig's ear of it because it can't focus enough to do it properly. Amazingly well acted though.
Okay, that was the Skeleton Twins.
Megatron must be stopped, no matter the cost.
A couple of new releases to look at now, the first of which is Transformers 5, The Last Night 5, which we've all seen, and let's just get out of the way now. It's unmitigated shite.
Yeah, yep, very well put. I mean, that is the review.
Right, let's move on, everybody. We're done here. Well, we're done here. Pack it up.
Well, no, we are almost done. I mean, Michael Bay, I've liked some of his work, mostly his earlier work, but he's just dived off a cliff of quality and landed in a cesspit of awful films.
Yeah, of his own making. I mean, it's a cesspit full of his own shit.
But I mean, like, I was just thinking this earlier. M. Night Shyamalan.
Shyamalan.
However you say it. Yeah, that's him. His earlier work I liked, and then he got worse and didn't do such good work. And then he did Switch, which I love. Maybe Michael Bay's got a Switch.
Split.
Maybe. maybe Michael Bay has got a split in him.
I mean, he did. It was called Pain and Gain. It was really, really good.
Yeah, I was going to say. And The Rock, I suppose, was his early one. The Rock is the one everyone loves. And then it was like basically anything between The Rock and Pain and Gain is shit. And everything apparently after that is shit.
Steve, you were about to say that Transformers 1 was actually quite good, weren't you? Yeah.
I did think Transformers, the first one, was okay. It kind of did what it needed to do. One of the biggest problems with the earlier Transformers films was all the Transformers seemed to be the same colour, so you couldn't tell who was it and who.
I mean, you still can't, because they're all terribly designed CGI monstrosities. But
They do look a bit better now than they used to.
They basically made all the good guys different colours, like bright colours, and all the bad guys grey.
Yeah. And whilst that, like they look different, but that doesn't help now that direction's... We'll get to like
incomprehensible.
I will get to the incomprehensibility here. But with this the first one, like, I mean, Michael Bay has never gotten the Transformers. Let's just get that away. Michael Bay has never gotten Transformers. Transformers is the tale of a boy in his car. like it's like a metaphor boy's car, and then there's all that bullshit lore around it, which kind of works because you have that grounding human element. Michael Bay has only ever seen it as a disaster movie. Mm. Like he has, that's the thing. Michael Bay has only ever seen these as disaster movies for whatever reason. But Transformers 1, I mean, it's a bad film, I find, but it almost works because it's the one that actually most closely has that boy in his car thing instead of drowning itself in lore bullshit. And now that, arguably, ever since now Shia LaBeouf's gone, it's now just become nothing but lore bullshit. As but just like this is, I sat down to watch this, and I mean, I was dreading it, obviously. Why wouldn't I? But I also was, for an hour and a half, I was trying. Like, I was trying not just to like it. I was also trying to understand what the fuck was going on. This...
Well, on that point, I think the three of us and many people we've spoken to about this film have struggled with the plot and to understand what was happening. Throughout the film, it seemed to be, from talking to you all before this and reading people's tweets, that nobody knew what was happening in the plot. So... I have got up. I don't care if I spoil this for people, because if one person doesn't go and see this film because I've spoiled it,
it's a service.
I've done the world a service.
I mean, the real public service here is that you're about to reveal to us what actually happened in that movie make sense of the utter migraine migraine that happened. So go on.
Well, I've gone onto the Wikipedia page for the film, and I'm going to read out the plot to you verbatim from the Wikipedia page, exactly what it says.
Hang on, let me get myself some hot cocoa here. Here we go. Yeah.
Yes. This is how the Wikipedia page starts. Transformers 5, The Last Knight. In 484 AD, King Arthur's wizard Merlin forges an alliance with the Knights of Iacon, a group of 12 Transformers who have hidden on Earth. The Knights have given Merlin an alien staff and combined into a dragon to help Arthur triumph over the Saxons. I can't remember my GCSE history too much, but I don't really think you needed a robot dragon to defeat the Saxons.
I mean, in the Dark Ages, there were apparently also giant explosions, which it was surprising. Oh, and this entire sequence basically just stopped for like a minute and a half, so Stanley Tucci can do some drunk ad-libbing for some reason. Is Stanley Tucci best pals with Michael Bay or something? Because he was also in the last one as well.
He was, a completely different kind of character.
Yeah.
With no link mentioned between them. He's just recast Stanley Tucci in a role.
He's also, only in the movie for that one scene, is fourth billed, whilst the female lead, who is actually important, has relevance to the plot, is shunted to that kind of, and also starring list that comes after, like, the main titles.
And as good an actor and as well-regarded as Stanley Tucci may be, are the kind of people who are going to enjoy and want to go and see a Transformers film really going to see a Transformers film because Stanley Tucci...
For 90 seconds.
Not at all. Exactly. No one's going to see this film because they want something that, you know, the film is advertising in terms of the poster, in terms of the trailer. People go to this because it's Transformers and they've already sat through four of them.
People are snidely
going to mock it and then deride it so we can write a review and do a podcast. Or there were people in the cinema screening when I was there who genuinely seemed to enjoy this kind of shit.
Yeah, I could hear laughter at many lines, despite the fact that there was I couldn't see jokes, mainly because mainly because, like, the editing of this movie, that, like, there are bits where dialogue just sort of like runs over each other, like like no break, like, so the editing. We'll get back to Steve's plot in a minute, but I just need to, like this movie is fucking incoherent. Like, it's literally incoherent. And not just in the usual way that, like, Michael Bay's Transformers movies have been, or even 13 Hours, which I thought was actually incoherent for the first hour and then finally settled down for a second hour. But, like, this is incoherent from start to finish. Like, scenes just kind of change on a whim. Characters get from point A to point Q to point Z at certain points for no reason. Plots drop in and out.
Yeah, considering... Sorry, carry on.
I say, plots drop in and out randomly and that there. Like, the opening minute, like, the opening hour goes through, like, 17 different main characters and plots and threads. And then eventually Anthony Hopkins shows up and both our lead characters both go, "Can somebody please tell me what the hell is going on?" I felt screaming out, "Yes, please, somebody, anybody, what the fuck is going on?"
They did exactly the same thing in Revenge of the Fallen. when they just stop the plot suddenly to have that big plane dude start explaining what's happened, what's happening now, and what's going to happen in the end. Because otherwise you'd have had no clue.
Yeah.
To carry on with the plot and what's going on, we then skip to the present day. In the present day, most of the governments on Earth have declared Transformers illegal, and the Multinational Transformer Reaction Force, brackets TRF, has been formed to eliminate all alien robots.
Which was also a plot of the last just for the record.
Yes. Yeah. Despite the absence of Optimus Prime, in brackets, who left the planet to search for his creator, new Transformers continue to arrive regularly. The newest ship to arrive crash lands in Chicago, where it is ground by a group of children. When a TRF mecha confronts the kids, they are saved by Isabella, a survivor of the Battle of Chicago, and her Transformer companions, Squeaks and Canopy. But Canopy is killed by a TRF in the process. Bumblebee and Cade Yeager arrive and help them escape. Yeager is unable to save the Transformer, Steelbane, in the ship. Before he dies, Steelbane attaches a metallic talisman to Yeager's body, an act observed by Decepticon Barricade, who reports to his leader.
Where
Megatron.
Did Barricade even come from? Just like as a question, just there
was
just
he
one
was
point where he just,
dead.
Yeah, like not even that. Like there was just a point where he just suddenly showed up, like in a random shot somewhere during that whole experience. It's like, wait, where is he? What's he going on? Is he a good? What? Like he just kind of showed up at one point, just randomly in a shot, and then Megatron was also just around the corner somewhere. Somehow,
just negotiating with them, and they're just like, yeah, sure, you can have all these people.
Oh yeah, the bit. Where, oh yeah, the bit where Michael Bay just does Suicide Squad for 5 minutes for no reason.
But like, even like that's not explained either, is it?
No,
it's not. It's just like he's suddenly negotiating with them because he's got some hostages that we didn't see happen.
I feel like that entire sequence is either Hasbro stopping the movie for 5 minutes to go and look at these brand new toys, kiddies, that you can get in stores right now. Cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. But also, as if like Michael Bay had watched Suicide Squad last year and taken it as like a personal offense. It's like, you think you can out incoherent barrel scrape me, good sirs? Well, you will allow me to prove you wrong. Oh god, what about the aspect ratio? I just have to complain about the aspect ratio. The aspect ratio,
it was awful.
Yeah, like what I get that it's made for IMAX, but every single shot changes the aspect ratio in some way, and it drove me up the goddamn wall. And like either shoot the whole film in IMAX or make the film in one fucking aspect ratio. Stop going between. It indicates just general sloppiness and non-existent. This is probably the most hysterically sloppy movie I have ever seen a major studio put out. Like, I don't think I've actually seen a blockbuster that is so badly made than this.
Yeah. And it was something to do with he used two IMAX cameras simultaneously as well. He was shooting everything on two IMAX cameras,
and apparently most of them weren't in the same aspect ratio as one another.
Yeah. So it's just like, not even like it's artistic license. It's just bad. It's just badly made.
Six fucking editors, which makes sense given how that movie, on both a giant, like on the macro level of, you know, plot, on the micro level of scenes, on the, from scenes, sequences, line, even individual shots, nothing makes any sense here. It is absolutely incoherent. It's not a film. This is not a film.
There's no continuity either. Like you watch, it's clearly made by someone who has no clue about the geography of the country they're filming. It's 1 minute they're driving under the Bridge of Sighs, and the next minute Big Ben is in the background. It's like, well, are you in Oxford or are you in London? Oh, it's all the fucking same, isn't it? It's all just the UK. No one who's going to see this film who we're aiming this towards really gives a shit. They just see old buildings.
I feel like I've kind of inadvertently taken the power of this is not a film away from the statement from the few times I've used it of Fantastic and Entourage and all that stuff in my head. But this genuinely is not a film to me. This is 9,000 vines smushed together and played one after another at maximum volume for 2.5 hours instead of an actual film. It's not a film. It's a $217 million migraine inducer. And I honestly don't know whether I find it hysterical, like whether I kind of have a sort of admiration for this, an anger for it wasting my time, or whether Michael Bay has just inadvertently created some kind of post-film type thing. It's mad.
Where do we get to? On the far reaches of the solar system, Optimus Prime discovers that the Transformers homeworld Cybertron, now disassembled into pieces, is heading directly for Earth. Optimus finds that being in control of Cybertron's movement, a sorceress named Quintessa, who professes to be the maker he is searching for. The staff which the Knights gave to Merlin was stolen from Quintessa, and using her powers, she places Optimus under her control and charges him with recovering it. Earth, she reveals, is actually Cybertron's ancient enemy Unicron, and she intends to drain his life force so that Cybertron can be restored.
I was going to ask, though, you know this dragon thing, right? The three-headed Hydra dragon robot thing.
Yeah, I haven't got to...
Is that made up of the Knights who are Transformers?
Yeah.
They transform into that.
I explained that in the first paragraph.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So, I mean, no wonder you didn't know what was going on in this film. You can't even follow this. The one thing is, now I can't quite remember. Right, in the fourth film, right at the beginning, you saw some alien spaceships come to Earth and started terraforming, and they had like weird little alien hands. You didn't see the aliens properly, except the little weird alien hands, but they weren't robot hands. Has that ever come back?
Nah. Why would it?
Nah.
That would suggest again continuity between the films.
Yes.
Maybe they made Unicron or something. Mm. I don't know. This is a movie that seems to believe that Starscream betrayed Megatron at some point when he never has. So
TRF member and former Autobot ally William Lennox brokers a deal between the TRF and Megatron, releasing from their custody a squad of Decepticons who will help Megatron recover the talisman from Jaeger.
Sorry, hang on. Who's Lennox? Is that the generic white guy that the film kept focusing on so much, despite the fact we had no character or anything to do, and I was expected to somehow know
who?
Him?
Which, what?
Lennox, the white army guy who kept being in all the action scenes. Wasn't it more than most Transformers? Also, Glenn Moore showers.
William Lennox was played by Josh Duhamel.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Him, yeah. That guy, you know. Yeah. That guy of talent and repute.
It might be Dumble.
Oh, yeah. And also Glenn Morshower plays himself. I don't know why.
The Decepticons hunt Jaeger to his junkyard hideout in South Dakota, where he and many of the surviving Transformers are holed up. During the chaos of the ensuing battle, Jaeger is approached by Cogman, the Transformer envoy of British Lord Sir Edmund Burton.
Played by Anthony Hopkins.
Yes,
not Cogman, the other guy.
Who takes him and Bumblebee to England to meet his master. There, Jaeger also meets Vivian Wembley, an Oxford professor who Burton has had the Autobot Hot Rod kidnap. Burton explains that he is the last living member of the Witwicken Order. Now, remember Witwicken? Witwicky was the surname of Shia LaBeouf's character in the first three films.
God, I can feel brain cells dying right now, Steve.
It's almost as boring to hear it again as it was watching it.
An ancient brotherhood dedicated to guarding the secret history of Transformers on Earth. He also reveals that Vivian is the last descendant of Merlin and must find a new star to prevent the impending destruction of Earth by Cybertron. I'll carry on.
Why not?
I'm nearly done. Fleeing the TRF, Jaeger and Wembley. Wow, such an English name, Wembley. It's not even got the E on it. It's just Wembley. Follow clues left by the latter's father that led them, Bumblebee and Cogman. Why give clues? Just make it easy. Be over.
I think Michael Bay wanted to make an Indiana Jones movie.
It sounds like it, doesn't it? There's really two contenders for the worst film to have King Arthur in this year.
Come on. Guy Ritchie's film is at least a film. Okay, yeah. Come on.
And Cogman takes the submarine HMS Alliance into the sea to find a Cybertronian Knight's sunken ship, in which they discover the tomb of Merlin and the staff. Wembley activates the staff and the ship rises to the surface. The TRF arrives to confront the group. Several Knights awaken and attack them. The attack is cut short by the arrival of the mind-controlled Optimus, now dubbed Nemesis Prime. But fortunately, when the normally mute Bumblebee is finally able to speak, the sound of his voice is enough to break Prime free of Quintessa's control.
For the record, by the way, this is treated as if it's a giant payoff to some kind of huge character arc between the two through some kind of plot. As if this has been happening either throughout the franchise. I don't think the two have actually like communicated that much about the franchise, other than again, I can't remember much of these, even though I've seen all five of them. But at least in this movie, it's treated as some kind, like the snapping out of Matt there and their eventual rekindled friendship is treated as if it's the end of some kind of huge character arc out there between the two, like a huge relationship rekindling, despite the fact that these two do not communicate with each other until Optimus Prime returns, and that Optimus Prime is out of this movie for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then he
shows up. And he doesn't transform either.
No, no.
You know, what's the, isn't this like meant to be selling toys?
There's one point where he disappears and just says that he's going to fight a way through for them, that they like to get them into the big, you know, like thing.
Yeah.
He just disappears for like 15 minutes and is as if we're supposed to all have faith in him or something about there. And just,
we're getting there. A moment later, Megatron arrives to steal the stuff. He too has been working for Quintessa all along. As Megatron flees with his prize, the Knights attack Optimus for his betrayal, but Jaeger, whose talisman becomes a sword Excalibur for some reason, because King Arthur was in
because Mark Wahlberg needs his ego stroking even more, apparently.
With his Excalibur sword, he stops the fight, realizing he is the last knight. The knights yield to Jaeger, who urges Optimus to protect the Earth once more. So that's a bit of it.
And then Tony Hale shows up and says, magic is stupid. We need to use science to fix this.
Mm. Megatron delivers the staff to Quintessa, who begins training the life force of Earth/Unicron via Stonehenge. Because, obviously. When the military intervenes, Megatron shoots Burton, who dies with Cogman at his side. Isn't that nice? Using a ship procured... It doesn't say that on Wikipedia. I added that bit. Using a ship procured by the Autobot Daytrader, never heard of him, the Autobots arrive to join the fight, landing on Cybertron and battling...
Sorry, that's Steve Buscemi's character.
Right.
They didn't say it was him who gave it to him in the film, but so it, like, a ship just shows up at one point and they're like, okay, I guess we're going to go join the fight, but it's apparently going on somewhere. Oh, and also, whilst this is happening, Hong Kong's wiped off the map. Nobody cares.
No.
Audience.
It's not even mentioned on Wikipedia about Hong Kong.
Like in the film, Hong Kong, which is where the entire last third of Age of Extinction took place, and which stopped, let's not forget as well, so that China could step in and advertise itself by saying that we will always protect our Hong Kong brethren, is wiped off the face of the map and nobody cares. Hong Kong gets a title card, by the way, and then it immediately cuts to the pyramids and there's no title card.
Anyway, we landing on Cybertron and battling against the Decepticons and Quintessa's Infernicons. Optimus and his Autobots, backed up by the Knights in their dragon form, vanquish their many foes. Optimus defeats Megatron while Bumblebee appears to slay Quintessa. Wembley removes the staff, stopping Cybertron's destruction of Earth, but leaving the two planets connected. Optimus declares that humans and Transformers must work together to rebuild their worlds and sends a message calling any Autobots to come home.
This also, by the way, skips out the fact that Isabella girl also shows up during the finale. She shows up, somebody asks her, what are you doing here? And even she says, I don't know.
Yeah. You've got a family now. See you later.
She shows up in a place she's not supposed to. Somebody asks her, how did you get here? And she answers, I don't know.
In a mid-credits scene, scientists inspect one of the horns of Unicron, which is extended out of the desert. Quintessa, who has survived and is disguised as a human, arrives and offers them a way to destroy Unicron.
Ah, I see. They're finally paying off that one subplot in Transformers Revenge of the Fallen that made no fucking sense.
Yes. The end. That was Transformers 5.
Don't watch Transformers, please.
No.
Please. No. I genuinely drove home with a massive thumping headache after watching that. It was awful.
We've done Transformers 5 now. We've got some fun out of it with that. But let's talk about Baby Driver, which is the new Edgar Wright directed film starring Ansel Elgort. Kevin Spacey, Jamie Foxx, John Hamm, and others. And in my opinion, was just brilliant. It's very rare that you get films out of Hollywood now that genuinely have a modicum of originality, and this was one of them.
I'm loving the shade you're throwing Bayformers way, Steve.
Yeah, but this was genuinely brilliant. It was fun.
Yeah.
It was funny. It was exciting. The car chases were really well put together. For the plot, for anyone who doesn't know, it's about a getaway driver called Baby, who has a love for music, but also has to listen to music all the time because of an accident his childhood gave him tinnitus, and the music helped drain it out. And then, yeah, as you can expect, things don't go according to plan. Yeah.
It's a 70s crime movie plot, but you know, of the kind hearted, if the talented driver is a good soul stuck in a bad world of crime through bad circumstances, the one last jobs, the seemingly benevolent but actually very, you know, like scary and authoritative father figure boss, Kevin Spacey, the sweet girl, the heart of gold, who sweeps our kid off his feet with dreams of the open road, and just like it's all that. It's like it's good for the record that here, like the plot about it's good about there. But I also need to say it's irrelevant, in a way.
It's the music and the soundtrack and the way that it's incorporated, yeah, into the film,
yeah,
that makes it work. I mean, I think I read that, or I heard an interview with Jamie Foxx on the radio, and he was saying how Edgar Wright would say he would know how long the scene was going to be. He would then pick a song to fit that scene, and then he would build the scene and what happened in it around the song.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like so that's why, like, Baby Driver is a car chase musical. Mm-hmm. Right? Like it is. And again, like, as I mentioned, there is a plot. There are incredibly well-written characters, fantastic performances, brilliant direction. Like, seriously, Edgar Wright is one of our best working action directors, which this film should, you know, make perfectly clear. And it's also, all that is basically irrelevant. In a way, like it's still there, it's great amount there, but it's kind of irrelevant to what Baby Driver mainly is, which is a giant love letter to music. And whilst it's also like nostalgic music amount there, like in the same way like World's End was about nostalgia, it's also specifically very much in the now kind of music, the way we listen to music nowadays. That, like, in theory, because I mentioned this in my written review, which you can find over at callumpetch.com. Yes, I wrote again for once. In theory, because this movie is basically wall-to-wall needle drops, like, there's rarely a scene going on where there's not some kind of licensed song playing in the background. In theory, that should be utterly, irritating. Like, it should be like Suicide Squad. You know, like the opening of Suicide Squad, mm-hmm, where that just played, five different songs, one after the other, and that there were no breaks or anything in that there. But instead, it works for two reasons. The first is the breadth and variety of the songs. It's a fantastic soundtrack for record. Of course it is. It's an Edgar Wright movie. But it's for breath and variety. Like, if Suicide Squad was, an insufferable egotist bragging about how amazing their music collection is, amazing obscure their music collection is, despite the fact music collection consists entirely of greatest hits CDs from every single one of the artists on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs of All Time list. Flicking through any rock AM station at any time right there that plays only the best classic rock and roll standards. Baby Driver has variety and spades everywhere. Like, it's not, you know, like every scene flits between, you can have hip hop in one scene, soul in the next, classic rock, modern rock, all that kind of stuff. If there's a more name brand artist in there, then you can guarantee there'll be a more obscure pick that will fit the scene perfectly, but also might not be one you might recognize. Like, for example, when was the last time either of you thought of the Tyrannosaurus Rex incarnation of Mark Bolan instead of T-Rex?
Or Trex.
Trex, yeah. I was going to say.
Yeah, or Blur's Intermission soundtracking a botched robbery. Like the bit that's stapled onto the end of Chemical World on Modern Life is Rubbish and out there. It's like just like a hidden bonus track thing out there. Turns out to have been a perfect fit there. And also, however, the main reason why it works is because Suicide Squad saw music as nothing more than a cynical, cheap audience pop. Like, something that you sit there and go like, oh yeah, I recognise that tune. That's a cool tune. There's nothing else. It had no real interest or respect for music. Baby Driver respects and gets music. And gets in the way that people listen to it. Like, I mean, I'm not sure exactly how you both do that. You might have different lives to me. Hopefully, because therefore that means you live happier lives, but there we go. Music for me is like a very important, it's like a very important personal connected part to my life, and that there I have a very emotional reaction to it, but it's also a constancy in my life, and therefore I always have a song in my head. I'm always listening to a bunch of songs that I'm always listening to music all the time. I listen to music on the ride, I listen to music on the train, on the bus, driving, all that stuff. But music as well also kind of like fades in and out in a way. Like sometimes it's there in the forefront. You surrender yourself over to it totally. You focus on it. Other times it's just there in the background. It's just a daily facet of life. That as well, Matt. It can be used for connection, like to forge connections with other people, like having a song that you love that somebody else hasn't heard that you get to introduce them to and maybe forge a connection out of that. Or maybe somebody you don't know and you both share a song that you both like and that you do it and you form a brief connection that way. Mixtapes, CDs, remixes and that there. Like finding connections, finding a constancy, a variety of ever presence. And also that sometimes music can just soundtrack cool shit. Like the opening film essentially out there where Edgar Wright essentially redoes his video for Mint Royale's blues song to John Spencer Explosion's Bell Bottoms. And it is, you know, like it's perfect. And in that moment, just before he sets off out as Ansel Elgort, you know, it's dancing around his car, mouthing along and that there. It's the moment where you just realize that Edgar Wright just gets music. Like, he gets the power emotionally that a song can give you, how it works as a thrill of the chase, the pleasure of sharing. It's constant, ever presence, a facet of life that the sins and the tracks in, and how is able, and how essentially the film is able to visualize that kind of scenario in your head as to how you see music. Like have either of you like sat there, heard a song and just kind of sat down and just like imagined some kind of like action scene or car chase or romance scene, like something in your head to a specific song?
I can't say. I mean, a song, if you've heard it on the soundtrack to a film, if I hear it away from the film, I might remember the scene from the film it was in, but I haven't ever sat down, listened and sort of
I've heard stuff and thought this would work really well in this sort of
film. Like that. Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. Like that's the kind of thing that Edgar Wright seems to do. He seems to just get music in that way. Which, of course, he always has.
The soundtracks have always been quite a big part of the Cornetto trilogy as well. They've always, I mean, it's never to this extent, never been built around the soundtrack, but they've always been quite. Yeah. And what they do on the Cornetto trilogy, if you get the DVDs or the Blu-rays, is they have a trivia track because they're all quite referential, in lots of little in jokes or Easter eggs or things like that. And if you put that on while you're watching the film, you can see what, you know, all about the different songs they've picked and why they've picked them.
Yeah,
and it is quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah. As I said, like music's always been a part of Edgar Wright's work. Like even way back in Spaced, like via the scene where Tim and Daisy have like their shared epiphany at clubbing. Like going out clubbing and that there, and just understanding the joy of just releasing and dancing and that there. The moment Shaun of the Dead, where they sync up to Queen's "Don't Stop Me Now," which is also a lot of how, you know, Baby Driver's sequences go up and that there, syncing certain beats to beats of the music. Or Scott Pilgrim, especially, you know, with "Sex Bomb," "Crash My Boys," "Crash a Demon Head," and all that stuff. And the reason it works as well is because. Edgar Wright films are all about essentially taking very mundane, ever-present aspects of our lives. Like Space is about relationships, Shaun of the Dead, you know, like hitting a dead-end spot in your life, Hot Fuzz, the stifling nature of a small town, Scott Pilgrim, relationship baggage, and World's End, the perils of living in like too much nostalgia. Baby Driver is about music. It's about taking those things and then using the tropes of genre filmmaking to blow them up on the big screen to make them appear like bigger, huger, like as if like somebody's unlocked your brain and just turn and unspooled mundane thoughts into the most grand technical thing possible. Like cliche is to say, making like the ordinary look extraordinary, which is essentially what he's done here for music and also technically the nostalgia, since the whole film very much fetishizes that. Well, not fetishizing, but like loves that kind of 70s chase movie. You know, the chase plots, the good girl relationships, and out there, one last job, the car, all the songs on the soundtrack in some way have a link back. If they're not from pre-1980, they have a link back to like that era, like a musical touchstone back to that era. But I also managed to have that kind of distance that the World's End didn't. Like, World's End eventually is also about nostalgia, but kind of lost its thread towards the end because it overreached. Was about the perils of nostalgia until it suddenly wasn't, and that kind of left it a bit of a confused mess, although I still love The World's End, and I will fight people who try and say it's a bad movie. But instead, Baby Driver just uses that kind of nostalgia thing as more like window dressing to focus more on music. Because that's ultimately what this film is about, is that there is a plot, there are really well entertaining characters, some funny moments. I will mention, because I know Owens was disappointed this wasn't funnier, is this wasn't really supposed to be a comedy. Like, I went in knowing this wasn't really meant to be a comedy.
No, there were some very funny moments in it.
Yeah. There are some funny moments in that bit, but I think maybe...
The Michael Myers bit was hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah, like, that's like, because it's Edgar Wright, and he can't not make funny characters.
And I think as well, having the main character called Baby worked in the same way as Blackadder does having a character called Darling.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was just me, but it was just, for me, that was...
Well, there was also a character in this movie called Darling.
Yeah.
Sorry, so it looked like Owen was wanting to say something there.
Owen's not really spoken much about the film yet, so let's hear what Owen wants to say.
Pretty much everything that's just been said. I mean, I haven't really got anything to... I mean, I did enjoy it. I didn't think it was... I think what I mean by it wasn't as funny as I hoped it would be is, like, the jokes that were in it just made me kind of go, instead of, like, proper laughing, is what I mean, rather than...
Yeah, yeah.
There should have been more gags. I just meant that...
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah,
It didn't make me laugh as much as perhaps I thought it was going to be because of who was directing it. If you know what I mean? His other films, even World's End, had me properly laughing out loud.
Oh yeah, yeah. But I still think about the noun sequence constantly from the World's End.
So it was good. I enjoyed it. I thought it looked great. I also thought the only other negative thing I've got to say is because it's a film which, as we said, is basically like a musical. But a musical car chase. I thought some of the car chase scenes weren't quite as well edited as I thought they looked from the trailer.
Mm.
I thought that there were lots of cutaways. Considering it was all real car stunts, there wasn't CGI involved.
Yeah.
I think I saw it at Cineworld and there was a brief introduction from Edgar Wright because they seem quite fond of doing that for their... unlimited previews these days, and he seemed to be quite proud of the fact it was all real stunts. And I thought it's a shame that it didn't really show that off particularly well in the actual film. But otherwise, I mean, I haven't really got anything to complain about it. I enjoyed it. I came out of the cinema quite happy, and I would go and see it again for sure.
Yeah, I think specifically because, like, I feel like this is probably the purest Edgar Wright film as a result. Mm-hmm. Obviously all of Edgar Wright's films are Edgar Wright films. I think that's what most of us love about him, about there, is the fact this is a filmmaker who actually puts himself in all of his films with, like, such a distinct personality and drive and all that here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is also why I'm hesitant to put it, even though I love it and I think it's one of the best films of the summer, why I'm hesitant to put it right up there with all of his other work just yet. Repeat viewings obviously are coming and are a necessity for an Edgar Wright film. It's because this feels like his purest work, in that this is the purest look into Edgar Wright's mind, how it works, what he loves, the things he's passionate about, mostly unburdened by focusing on on things like deeper thematic resonance or complex plot twists and all that kind of stuff from out there. But at the same time, I love it for that, because that kind of passion just overflows the entire film out there and drives it forward and keeps it going. And it's just, for me in any case, I'm a huge mark for Edgar Wright, as anybody who has ever paid attention to any of my works will know. But to just sit there and kind of just watch somebody who sort of like me kind of gets music and is that passionate about music and that, it kind of, for me, it just meant I could surrender myself to it totally, and I adored it.
Interesting, because I love Adam Buxton, and I don't know if you listen to Adam Buxton's podcast, but he interviewed Edgar Wright quite recently.
Mm.
And because, you know, they're all part of the same sort of, I'm going to call it a clique. I think it is basically a clique with him and Joe Cornish and Louis Theroux. And
when is Joe Cornish going to make another film?
But that interview with Edgar Wright, I kind of stopped liking him that much. It's like, to hear him talk was, he just was constant. He makes a point of it himself. He's aware of what he's doing with the name dropping. But it was constant. And I just thought he didn't come across as a very nice person. I mean, it's perhaps unfair because it's an interview and maybe he was just having a bad day or whatever it was. But I just thought, I don't normally turn off the Adam Buxton podcast, but that one was, wasn't far off it.
I might have
to stop listening before it completely turns me off him.
Well, I love him, but also I probably never want to meet him because I'd just be like intimidated by his vast knowledge of films and music and everything out there. But I mean, let's focus on the films here, Matt Bear, which means that it's really, in the case of Baby Driver, it's really, really, really good and just, and it's going to bomb. It's going to bomb so, so badly. It's going to crash and burn because Sony are fucking idiots. And it's a shame because it's amazing. Who brought it forward from late August to the same week as Despicable Me 3? And why have they not been fired yet?
That was Baby Driver. Just before we go, got some recommendations for the week ahead. I'm going to television. I'm going to... Wednesday night, just after midnight on ITV4. If you want to depress yourself, if you're up that late, watch The Road.
Oof. Yeah, that is quite a depressing one to go for there.
Yeah, if you can't get to sleep, watch The Road and you will not sleep.
Well, at least it's probably not as depressing as the experience of watching Transformers.
No,
so
it can't be. Mm. It's impossible to be. Callum?
I am going to go for Sky Cinema, or the Sky Movies package, of those you have it, Matt Bear. And the Queen of Catway was just added. The Disney chess sports biopic with Lupita Nyong'o and David Oyelowo. No, everybody forgot about this as soon as it came out last year, which is a shame because it's great. Just a really great, really entertaining, heartfelt underdog sports story. Very well done, with excellent performances all around. Go check it out. It's really great.
And Owen?
On Film 4 on Thursday evening / Friday morning, whatever way round you wanna call it, 1:30 a.m. It's Barbarian Sound Studio by Peter Strickland, which I talked about on last week's podcast for our triple bill of dream jobs in movies. Stars Toby Jones, he's a sound recordist, flies to Italy to work on a Santini film, not a horror film, in the 1970s, and then things go a bit weird. But it's one of those that if you've got some way of watching it on a computer and putting headphones in rather than watching it on the TV, or unless you've got a really good surround sound system, then do that, because it's all about the audio, that film, and totally worth watching it in whatever way you're going to benefit from that, because it's just awesome.
Okay, that is all for this week's Failed Critics podcast. Thank you all for listening, and hope you haven't suffered through Transformers as much as we have. Next week,
probably won't be as much as me, because I did fall asleep.
Yes.
So we got it worse, really, didn't we, Steve?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if Owen really is going to be a proper film reviewer, he should go back and watch the whole thing.
Is that right? Is that what I've got to do? Waste another three hours.
Make that your punishment if you win the quiz.
I know he's got an unlimited card, so it won't cost him any money, so I won't feel guilty about doing it at all. What's up next week, Owen?
Next week is we have a triple bill podcast. It's me, Tony, and Brooker that was recorded in the Mitre in Oxford. It's got a triple bill, which is getting the band back together again, which, Steve, you provided before you couldn't then get back together with us.
Well, I actually provided it after I decided I couldn't make it. You guys were struggling for ideas, so
he likes irony. The man likes irony. What can you say?
Yeah. The last one we did was in the old Contemptibles in Birmingham. So this was all about films where it's about getting together an ensemble again. And I think we came up with some interesting choices, so that'll be worth checking.
Have I got a week off next week?
You've got a week off, Steve. Ooh. Yeah.
What am I going to do with my Monday evening?
How are people going to know whether Despicable Me 3 is any good or not, Owen? The people must know.
Yeah, because it won't do so well unless we find out it's good and then share it through word of mouth.
Yeah, I do it afterwards, Matt Bear, which is obvious. We are the people who will be able to stop the minions.
Yeah. Anyway, you can find the website at failedcritics.com. Thank you all for listening and joining us again, but not including me, next week for another podcast.
Sometimes when your hopes have all been shattered, there's nowhere to turn. You wonder how you keep going. Think of all the things that really matter and the chances you
Critics Podcast is presented by Steve Norman and Owen Hughes, with contributions from different guests every week, with original music provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com from the track The Bandit, remixed by James Yule, who you can find at jamesyule.com. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Failed Critics, on iTunes and all good podcast apps, or you can check us out at failedcritics.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and leave a rating or a review. And why not check out our sister podcasts, Character Unlock and Bill de Mullinger's Underground Nights, from the Failed Media Network of Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.